and welcome to HCA Talks Health. I'm your host, Zina LaRue, and I'm a health journalist and a health coach who specializes in functional nutrition. And I'm also a health and a nutrition trainer at the Health Coaches Academy. And our goal with these podcasts is to share with our audience the powerful ways in which people can take control of their health and transform the quality of their lives. And today I have the privilege to talk to the legendary Patrick Holford, and he absolutely needs no introduction, but I do find his resume very impressive, so I am going to mention just one or two things. So Patrick is the founder of the Institute of Optimum Nutrition, and he's also the author of, I think, 46 books, or where you're at, Patrick, is it 46?
Yeah, it's 46, is correct.
Okay, good. And his very first book, The Optimum Nutrition Bible, sold over 2 million copies, and your books have been translated into 30 languages. And what I absolutely love about your books, and I've read so many of them, is that you have the ability to really make complex nutrition science simple to understand. You know, and there's always these actionable steps in terms of how you can implement it and how you can make it part of your life. So thank you for being here, Patrick. It really is a privilege that you're joining us today.
My pleasure.
So the reason for today's interview is to talk more about the fascinating topic of Alzheimer's. And Patrick is currently running a campaign called Alzheimer's is Preventable, and that's through the Food for Brain Foundation. And your goal with this is the fact that you want to raise awareness about the importance of optimum nutrition in mental health. But you know what, I have to say that I find it quite sad that there hasn't been much awareness around this, maybe until recently. And I think there's still a lot of people, many physicians even, who believe that, you know, the deterioration of the brain is just linked to maybe the aging process, or, you know, it's just part of life, not much we can do about it, or due to chemical imbalances even. But what your research shows us is that optimum nutrition and other lifestyle interventions can be used to prevent brain-related disorders. So tell us a little bit more about that.
And I'd like to also unpack it in context. Many years ago, in my 20s, I did a course with the Dalai Lama. And one of the things I loved, he said that every human being has two fundamental desires. One is to be free of pain, and the other is to be happy. And he said that my interactions with people, I try to remember that my desire to be free of pain and happy is of no greater or lesser importance than theirs, which was very interesting. And really, I have many of my great teachers, Dr. Linus Pauling. Einstein's, when asked, "Are you a genius?" said, "If you want a real genius, it's Linus Pauling." He was the man who put vitamin C back on the map. Dr. Abraham Hoffer, who treated 6,000 patients with schizophrenia. And it was actually those two gentlemen, they both died in their 90s, super functional. I mean, Abraham Hoffer took 2 weeks off work, stopped seeing patients for 2 weeks before his death. And I was interviewing Linus Pauling about his amazing discovery to do with lipoprotein A and cardiovascular disease a few months, before his death. So the point is that these diseases, and in fact, my awakening happened about 1982, I remember I was driving down a hill in the Chiltern Hills in outside of northwest of London, and I suddenly had this crazy idea, because at the time it was crazy, that maybe all this heart disease and cancer and arthritis and mental illness it could be a function of suboptimum nutrition. And these two gentlemen had developed a concept called orthomolecular medicine, the right molecules. You have the right molecules, you don't get sick. And they're also pioneers in genetics and understanding that we're different. You know, we have our own genetic sort of uniquenesses. And then Jeff Bland studied with him and developed functional medicine. I studied with them and called it optimum nutrition. So the whole idea really was how to live a full and happy and healthy life with no physical or mental degeneration. Hence the books, Say No to Cancer, Say No to Heart Disease, Say No to Arthritis, and so on. But what's really fascinating about Alzheimer's, and in fact, you know, most people don't even think about it at all. I mean, you say it's a fascinating topic, but to be honest, for most people, they would consider it a boring topic, And yet what we find, and we know that the risk for developing Alzheimer's is measurable So it starts young, and in adolescence that we can pick up cognitive dysfunction. For example, in adolescence, we eat too much sugar. So it's kind of a long time coming. And what's become very clear is it's just another of what we would call metabolic diseases. And by the way, the big breakthrough, I recently wrote my book, Say No to Arthritis, because it's now clear it's not a wear and tear disease. It's actually a metabolic disease. So it has a lot of the same drivers that we see for diabetes and weight gain and heart disease, you know, and the main cancers like breast and prostate and so on. No different. And, you know, many people don't necessarily understand what it is. When you start to lose your memory significantly and the doctor sends you to a memory clinic and they do what's called a cognitive function test, if you don't score well, they diagnose you with what they call mild cognitive impairment, or you could call it pre-dementia. And if you do even worse, you get diagnosed with dementia. So a loss of cognitive function. And, you know, short-term memory goes, your ability to sort of do executive functions to sort of, you know, work things out and put them together and so on starts to deteriorate. Now, two-thirds of that dementia is a disease, and it is a disease, not a function of the aging process. You never need to get this. Of course, it's more common in older people, but it's not a function of the aging process. It's a shrinkage of a central part of the brain. It's called the medial temporal lobe or the hippocampus. And you can only diagnose Alzheimer's on a brain scan. So then we end up with two-thirds of dementia is Alzheimer's, and maybe a quarter is what they call vascular dementia, cerebrovascular dementia, so poor supply, blocked arteries, poor supply of nutrients to the brain. And both have exactly the same risk factors and exactly the same means to prevent. And if I'll give you an example just to sort of cut to the very recent news chase, so you understand we're not just talking fluffy prevention here. Last week or the week before, the newspapers were full of this new drug, lecanemab. It's actually a sort of antibody injection. So antibodies that are designed to go towards these blockages called amyloid plaque. And, front page head news, finally we have something that does something. And I was reading in The Guardian, they said, well, of course, we can't expect any drugs or any treatment to actually stop the disease process, which is to do with brain shrinkage. And sure enough, this class of drugs don't stop brain shrinkage. Well, it's not quite true. One of them showed a 2% reduction in brain shrinkage. Now, I work with a wonderful team at Oxford University, headed by Professor David Smith, who was the professor of pharmacology and the vice dean of the medical school. And he's achieved 73% less brain shrinkage.
Oh, okay? Fascinating. Yeah.
Right? I mean, 73% less brain shrinkage. Oof. Mm-hmm. Giving B vitamins to people who also have sufficient omega-3, and we can kind of unpack that. Mm-hmm. Also, the actual effect, you measure what's called the clinical dementia rating. It's an 18-point scale, and this new drug was the first drug to cross the line and get statistical significance with a 0.45-point drop. So imagine an 18-point questionnaire, and you're scoring less than half a point difference. Now, that would have no clinical effect at all. In other words, the person wouldn't notice, the carer wouldn't notice, it wouldn't do anything, mm-hmm. but the study was large enough to claim statistical significance. Now, the omega-3 and B vitamins are already, three times more effective on exactly the same measure. And to put it into context, in the study that, we can talk a little bit about, the participants, 30%, had a zero clinical dementia rating at the end of the study. So in other words, almost a third of people doing the B vitamins and omega-3 would no longer be diagnosed with dementia.
Oh, wow.
So even though we call it prevention, you can see straight away that actually, it's treatment.
It's treatment
as well as
well.
Prevention.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I'm curious about the combination of the omega-3 and the vitamin B. So it results in a 73% less of a shrinkage of the brain or part of the brain that is linked to memory loss, right? So what exactly is it? So I can have more or less an idea if I think about omega-3s, because we know that the brain is maybe around 60% fat and the synapses are made from, you know, the omega-3s. But the B vitamins, can you give us more info on why that's important?
So you're right, the brain is 60% fat, but if you actually go close up onto brain cells, you're looking at the structural fat, you know, is really what your brain is made out of. And most of it is omega-3, and very specifically a type of omega-3 called DHA, docosahexaenoic acid. It's part of omega-3, part of fish oils. So first of all, if you imagine, you know, a brain cell, it's got a very, very important layer or membrane or skin, if you like, which is through which all the signals, you know, all the communication is happening. And it has to be sort of water resistant. In other words, it has to be waterproof. And that waterproofness is made by attaching these stringy things, which is the omega-3 DHA, to blobby things called phospholipids. Phospholipids come from fish and eggs mainly. And the stringy things come, you know, mainly from marine food. There's no DHA in any plant food. Now, the thing is to put those bits together. It's done, if you like, by a glue, which kind of involves B vitamins. I mean, I'm paraphrasing here because there is a process called methylation. And when you're not able to do methylation, you can't build brain cells. And if you can't do methylation, your blood level of homocysteine, so there's a blood test, goes up. And particularly B12, B6, and folate. Folate, think foliage, think greens, and so on. But B12, again, is not in any plant foods. It's only animal foods. So you've got to have the combo. And I kind of like to explain a little. I mean, B12 is very rich in marine foods, too. But just to kind of explain the magic of this, in David Smith's first study, just giving the B vitamins, he got 52% less brain shrinkage. He then went back to the participants in the trial. These are all people with pre-dementia. And he looked at their omega-3 status. He didn't give them fish oils. He just looked at the blood level of omega-3. And those with the third lowest omega-3 had no benefit from the B vitamins, right? And those with the third highest omega-3 had 73% less brain shrinkage and much better effect. So if you imagine you've got to have B vitamins and omegas to build your brain, you could have all the omegas in the world, but if you don't have enough B vitamins, they won't work. You could have all the B vitamins in the world, if you don't have enough omegas, they wouldn't work. So, you know, to cut to the chase, a big study in Holland, which are given B vitamins, got a modest effect, went back to their results. And sure enough, they found the people with the high omega-3 in their blood had a much bigger effect. Then another very good study in Sweden, which had found minimal effect from the omega-3s, went back and looked at the participants' level of homocysteine in the blood. Low means good B vitamin status. And they found, yes, those with low homocysteine, massive effect from the omega-3. Now, B12 is probably the most significant B vitamin because it is our ability to absorb it seems to reduce with age. There may be some health reasons for that. And it's very rich in seafood. So now I'm convinced and have been for many years, as is David Attenborough and, you know, most leading scientists who actually know their stuff, that we didn't become Homo sapiens because we somehow miraculously dropped out of the trees, picked up spears and went hunting. That happened a lot later. We were actually the Homo aquaticus. We were the waterside ape. We started to exploit wetlands, swamplands, estuaries, rivers, etc., probably watching birds like storks, you know, rich pickings to be had with all those crabs and mussels and shells and fish and so on, and became upright. And we developed our layer of insulating fat, which for many of us has become a bit excessive. You know, babies are born with a diving reflex. They're born with a waxy waterproof vernix. That's the stuff they have to wash off babies, which isn't found in a single land-based mammal, but is identical chemically, biologically to that found in marine mammals like seals and so on. So I would say that our brain size grew and grew and grew from the point when we split from chimpanzees and gorillas and bonobos 6.5 million years. It grew and grew and grew and reached a peak of about 1.5 kg 100,000 years ago. And 10,000 years ago, it's 1.5 kg. Now it's 1.35 kg. So modern man has a 10% smaller brain than our ancestors, you know, 10 or more thousand years ago. And I think that that happened because a large part of our diet was marine food, which would give the DHA to build the brain. It would give the phospholipids. It would give the B12. And then one other sort of fact there is, I mean, in the UK, we recently discovered an ancient Homo sapiens remains going back some 35,000 years. And when they analyzed the bones, I mean, the story that the BBC told was they'd be wandering across the plains, hunting antelope with spears and so on. And of course, there was a bit of that. But when they analyzed the bones, almost one quarter of their diet was seafood.
Wow.
And then you get the B12, you get the phospholipids, you get the DHA, all the things that were actually required for the evolution of Homo sapiens. And if you go to the National Institute of Health, they did a very good study of all studies looking at what we call population attributable risk. How much risk is attributed to Alzheimer's? And the answer was 22% to a lack of seafood and omega-3, and 22% to raised homocysteine and a lack of B vitamins. So what we've actually got there is two very big preventable risk factors, which we already know are not only risk factors, but can be reversed. In other words, we are talking about a disease-modifying treatment that is leagues ahead of the best drugs, which was spent $50 billion to develop, and have finally managed just to cross a small line while reporting that one in five people who are given these drug treatments will have brain bleeding or swelling.
Oh, gosh.
At a cost of $10,000 a treatment.
Yeah. It's
and just... we've only covered two factors. There are about 20 prevention risk factors.
Wow.
No, and only 1% is caused by genes. This is a really important point I should have said. That actually, Alzheimer's is not principally a genetic disorder. Only less than 1 in 100 cases of Alzheimer's are caused by genes. And there are certain genes like the AP gene, the presenilin gene. And if you happen to have that in your family, there will be very early onset in the age 50, 60 Alzheimer's. But if people are getting in their 70s, 80s, 90s, you can be pretty damn sure you're not one of those less than 1 in 100.
But that's something that I hear quite often, is that people tell you, but you know, it's purely genetic, nothing we can do about it. And then they just sit back and they enjoy their takeaways and their fizzy drinks. And you know, it's not up to them. And but what you're telling us now is that I think around half of the risk factors is within our control, you know, or more than that.
Well, I would, that's true. That's absolutely true. And nobody really disagrees with that. And probably, and we will be publishing some data on this in due course, but I probably most people can cut their risk by at least three quarters. But what's fascinating about Alzheimer's, unlike, you know, type 2 diabetes, I mean, you know, I was hung, drawn, and quartered so many times in my life. When I said type 2 diabetes is a reversible disease, you know, I was hung, drawn, and quartered, but now people are really accepting that that is the case, and it's got a lot to do with sugar and carbs. But unfortunately, Alzheimer's is holes in the brain, and we do not have any way of reversing that. So somehow, I mean, it's very hard to sell a prevention message because people don't usually bother to do anything until they're in pain, you know, as the Dalai Lama said. But somehow we have to wake up people to the idea that it's not a genetic disease. It's not, it won't be solved by drugs. And there's a very obvious reason I can tell you for that. So it really is down to you. And we do know what you need to do it. And at our charity, foodforthebrain.org, we've been working for the last 15 years to make it doable. In just the way you said, my books tell you what to do. We've been developing something that I'd like to unpack with you because I think people will be really interested.
Absolutely. I'm just thinking about what you mentioned a bit earlier about the omegas and the vitamin B. So I'm curious about why it is that we are so deficient. So I think you answered the question with regards to we not eating as much seafood as we used to, I guess.
Definitely.
Yeah, and but with regards to the B vitamins, so is it just the quality of the foods that we're having? Is it modern lifestyle?
No, I think with the omegas, you see, you know, it's a bit like, I mean, the point is that we're actually now living a lifestyle that is really out of kilter with our evolutionary design. I mean, many people ask, you know, why do I need to supplement? And they give various reasons. The soil is poor and people eat the wrong foods and so on. But the single biggest reason why people need to supplement is because we don't eat enough. We are eating less than half of what our ancestors ate because we're expending far less calories. We don't need to. So our ancestors ate probably two or three times more food than we did. It was all organic. It was all whole. You know, there were no fridges. There were no cars. You had to, you know, walk everywhere and chop wood and fetch water and so on. So I remember there was a study of mid-Victorian worker diet. And the level of micronutrients, zinc, essential fats, you know, B12, that they were achieving from their diet, which, by the way, had a lot of seafood, eels and mussels and all the rest of it. I mean, all of humanity has evolved next to the water's edge, was so high that the authors concluded the only way we could achieve the same today would be to supplement. Right. So what you have to ask is my brain in the 21st century working less hard than the brain of somebody 100 years ago? And the answer is we say, no, it's more hard. I mean, just about every week I've got to learn some new technical skill just to keep my computer working. You know, we're flooded with news. We're flooded with information. We're learning all the time and so on. So our brain's needs haven't changed, but the supply has changed.
Mm.
So what's fascinating is, I mean, I supplement every day two called essential omegas, and they have omega-3, a little bit of omega-6, DHA, EPA, and I achieve 300 to 400 milligrams of DHA. And I think I'm doing well, and I eat oily fish as well. Now, when you actually look at the research, and it's very clear, it's unequivocal, the amount of DHA that optimizes brain function, reduces risk of Alzheimer's the most is 1,000 milligrams of DHA.
Mm.
Now, you know, that is like three fish oil capsules a day. I mean, that's a lot.
Mm.
Now, but it would have been easily achieved by our ancestors. So I think the answer is we're not eating anything like the level of seafood that was available at the times that our brains evolved.
Mm.
So the sort of take-home message is and also it's like, you know, eating fish cuts risk for Alzheimer's, and eating fish three times a week cuts it more than two times a week, cuts it more than one time a week. So, you know, and I'm leaving aside any sort of ecological argument here about running out of fish in the oceans and all the rest of it. Mm. But the truth is we're dumbing down because we don't have enough supply of omega-3. And if on an individual level, you want to eat oily fish at least three times a week, plus supplement omega-3 essential fats, no question.
Mm-hmm.
On the B vitamins, it's slightly different. I mean, folate, of course, is, and we do find a sort of similar thing, because the level of folate that you probably optimize as brain health is 600 or 800 microgram. Now, you know, you've got to be eating at least seven servings of fruit and veg, you know, to get into that zone, probably more. And once again, our ancestors would have been doing that absolutely no problem. They weren't just eating marine food. It was a mix. But we're not. So, yeah, we've got to, you know, really be good on that. And of course, a lot of people are getting into low carb diets have sort of almost demonized fruit, you know, so you're just down to the veg. And, you know, I like to say half a plate, a main course, if half the plate is veg, that's two servings. So, you know, lunch, dinner, that's four, and you need another three. So folate, yeah, is low. And again, I think it's worth both supplementing. Then B12 is a really interesting one because, and we don't exactly know why this is, but if you just look at average people, levels of stomach acid, so stomach secretions, have reduced to about a quarter. I'm in my mid-60s. So if someone's 20 and now I'm in my mid-60s, my level of stomach acid on average would be almost a quarter of that of a younger person.
Mm.
Now, people don't realize stomach acid is vital. It's like it kills bugs, you know, number one. Number two, when you eat protein, it tells the muscles, the sphincters, the circular muscles either side of the stomach to shut off, and that makes an acid bath. Number three, it makes acid, which breaks down your proteins. And number four, it makes you absorb B12. So if you have a lack of stomach acid, you're just not so able to absorb B12. And the irony is that if you have a lack of stomach acid, you don't kill all the bugs, so you get dysbiosis. So you don't digest all your food. So the bugs in your gut eat some of your food. That makes gas. It's high up, so you've got to belch. You haven't shut the circular muscles fully anyway. So you belch and you get a little bit of acid in your esophagus. So you get heartburn. So you go to the doctor with heartburn, belching, bloating, indigestion. And what they do is they give you a drug like omeprazole, which is called a proton pump inhibitor, PPI antacid, which stops you making any stomach acid. Now, of course, if you don't make any stomach acid, you're not going to get heartburn because you've got no stomach acid. But you're not going to digest your food. You're not going to kill your bugs. So, you know, even though this isn't proven, I mean, Linus Pauling, before he died, he said, Patrick, follow the logic. But, you know, a New Zealander a long time ago did an experiment where he consumed Helicobacter pylori, so a pathogenic bacteria, sure enough, got ulcers. So everyone thought stress causes ulcers, and he proved that the bacteria causes ulcers. And now it's treated with antibiotics and whatever. But why would you have a pathogenic bacteria able to live in the stomach? And the answer is probably because your stomach acid level has been falling, and that's leading to dysbiosis. And then one of the knock-on effects is you don't absorb B12. And by the way, by now, with your crap diet, you've probably got diabetes, so they're going to give you metformin, which inhibits B12 absorption. And by now, your blood pressure is high, so they're going to give you diuretics, which eliminate the B vitamins. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons why a person might end up not absorbing B12. Now, the thing is about B12 is you just don't know. So in one big study in the UK, 2 in 5 people over 60 had insufficient B12 in their bloodstream, not in their diet, but in their bloodstream to prevent brain shrinkage, accelerated brain shrinkage. Now, you wouldn't know whether you're 1 of the 3 in 5 or 1 of the 2 in 5. It's not obvious. That's the point. So in an ideal world, we should all be having our homocysteine level tested. And it's very difficult. But actually, due to a campaign I ran some 20 years ago in South Africa, there was a time where in South Africa, you could actually go to, I think it was PathLab, I can't remember the name of the laboratories, but PathLab, MedLab, you know, there were various ones in most of the major cities that you could go to and for, you know, not too much, get your homocysteine level measured. And you want it below 10. Above 10, you've got accelerated brain shrinkage. So if you say to me, how do I know if I'm getting enough B vitamins? I'd say, get your homocysteine measured. And several years ago, I was in South Africa, and there was a guy called Chris Kruger, and he came up to me in one of the seminars. He said, I'm absolutely brain dead. I mean, my brain is not working. I keep losing my car in multi-story car parks. I mean, my memory is just terrible. And I measured his homocysteine. Above 10 is brain shrinkage. His was over 100.
Wow.
And sure. I gave him a supplement, you know, B6, B12, folate. We also use zinc and trimethylglycine, that would lower it, and told him to eat more beans and greens rich in folate and fish and all that sort of stuff. And when I came back 6 months later, his homocysteine level was 9. Wow. And he said that his memory was better than it had ever been in his life. So he recovered function. Oh, so if we were really doing prevention, we'd be testing homocysteine as often or as easily as we test cholesterol.
Oh, wow. It's so powerful, hey? So it's, like you said, it's not just prevention, it's even treatment and reducing. Like, I mean, this guy said that his memory was the best that it's ever been in his life. So it's even improved his memory in some way, right? So I think this is very important to think about, why we should be paying attention to Alzheimer's. We know that it's a big killer. It's a highly feared disease. And I think also when we think about the healthcare costs, right? There's a lot of healthcare costs, and I know there's something like 160 million cases projected globally for 2050, if I've got it correctly, and even potential bankruptcy of the medical system, you know, and there's obviously a lot of concern around that, because like you said, some of the treatment methods that is out there kind of have a 2% brain shrinkage ability, right? It's a very important issue to address and to think about. So you mentioned earlier that you won't necessarily know whether, you know, you're low in vitamin B. But is there any signs that you should be on the lookout for as a younger person? Because I know in your research you said that the shrinkage of the brain, or, you know, even before you get diagnosed with dementia, it's starting like 20, 30 years before you're diagnosed. So exactly. How would you know that?
Well, the thing is, the cognitive function test that's done in memory clinics, which measures the very specific changes that occur in cognition. We got permission some 10 years ago to digitize it. So we built the first ever free online digital cognitive function test. And we've tested over 380,000 people. So every day I get a note, you know, that every day there's 50 to 100 people doing the cognitive function test at foodforthebrain.org. So that's a no-brainer, because what we know is that you can pick up the beginning of cognitive changes 30 years before a diagnosis. Mm. So we don't yet know, certainly from age 50, you need to be doing a cognitive function test. And by the way, I mean, there's a lot more to say than I've said, but for example, we got the health economist, Oxford University, to look at what would happen if doctors got their older patients to do a cognitive function test. If not good, measure the homocysteine. If above 10, give them the B vitamins. Mm-hmm. How much would that save over 5 years across the EU with reasonable compliance? And the answer was 60 billion euro. Right. It's sure. And this is like, you know, 10 cents a day treatment. It's like nothing. Yeah. So what really happens, so the first thing we did was to build the cognitive function test. And I would implore everyone listening to get everyone they know over 40 to do the test. And one of the problems, the barriers we want to overcome is we go, oh, I don't want to do it because I don't want to know. You know, that's a big thing. But you do want to know, because the earlier you know, the more you can do about it.
Mm.
And you really can make changes. So that was kind of like step one. And then we started to research that with University College London and the NHS here. And we started to ask questions about people's diet and lifestyle. And it was really qualitative research to find out what the barriers were. So people said, I don't want to do it. I don't want to know. It's in the genes anyway. I can't change anything. So mm-hmm. part of our campaign is breaking down those mm-hmm. illusory statements. So the next thing we did, and I'm so honored and delighted, is that there's actually about, you know, 30 risk factors. Mm-hmm. And I'll just run sort of quickly. Sugar and carbohydrates, mm-hmm. your blood sugar balance is definitely one. B vitamins we've covered, essential fats we've covered, but it's not just essential fats. There are other brain fats like vitamin D and phospholipids. Then there are antioxidants and polyphenols, which are the things in fruit and veg and even in chocolate. You know, there's some nice things in there, and blueberries and so on. And then there's healthy gut. Now, there's not enough evidence in the area of the gut and the microbiome yet, but it's, you know, very interesting and it is evolving. And then there's being active physically. And your muscle mass is actually the best predictor of brain mass, muscle mass. Mm. So actually building muscle builds brain in a very interesting way. Then there's being active socially and intellectually. And then there's sleep. So we know that 7 hours is perfect. People who sleep 6 hours or 8 hours have greater risk for dementia. You know, owls, you know, go to bed later, have greater risk than people who go to bed. The optimum time to go to bed is like 10. And mm-hmm. optimum 7 hours. So there's sleep, and then there's stress. And what I'd like to say very quickly, and you'll immediately get this, is that actually, I mean, let me give you another risk factor. Cataracts is a risk factor for dementia. Cataracts.
What? Wow, right? Nice.
So, and hearing losses too. So then the question is, if people have cataract surgery, does it then reduce their risk?
Mm.
So something can be a risk factor, but it, you know, can you reduce it? And the answer is yes. Cataract surgery reduces risk for dementia. So what's actually going on here is that I remember years ago, there was a lovely man called Fritjof Capra, who wrote a book called The Tao of Physics. And he was one of the first guys talking about systems theory. Mm-hmm. And how, if you want to understand a complex adaptive system, you have to look at the whole thing. And he would, I played tennis with him when I was about 15. And yes, I was looking at one of his books on my shelf, but he would say, what's the difference between an animate object, like a bicycle, and an inanimate object, and an animate object, like you or I? And we would say a bicycle's got bits, and the bits relate, you know, the chain turns the wheel and the handlebars and so on. And we've got bits, and our bits relate, but we've got this life flowing through.
Yeah.
And like in the brain, you've got this neural network that's got stimulation all the time. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, what I realized, I mean, no one actually has a unified theory of what's causing cognitive decline.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there is the theory of amyloid, but it's wrong. 300 failed trials have shown that. But actually, you can fit every single known risk factor into either structure. In other words, the stuff we're made out of. So when we were talking about the brain being made out of omega-3, phospholipids, needing B vitamins, its structure, the function, we're talking about fuel. So brain cells need fuel. So all the talk about sugar and the wrong kinds and, you know, ketone diets, the brain loves ketones.
Mm-hmm.
And when you make energy, you make antioxidants, you make oxidants. So you need those antioxidants. That's all part of the function, so to speak. Circulation, you know, as part of the function. We know that homocysteine, if raised, increases the risk of vascular problems in the brain by 17 times, right?
Mm.
Massive. But then, so you've got to have structure, you've got to have function, then you need utilization. Mm. If you don't use it, you lose it. And using it, I mean, if you climb up a mountain or walk up a hill or go dancing or do anything that is not totally monotonous, your body is having to adjust all the time. It's using your brain. We know that taxi drivers, when they do their exams, they actually get thicker brains, more gray matter.
Wow.
Socializing, like we're having a fast conversation here. You know, when you're with people and you've got to answer things really quickly, socializing stimulates the brain. Cataracts, right? Hearing. If you can't hear and you can't see, you've got less stimulation to your brain. Mm. And then what sleep is recovery after a day of mental activity.
Mm.
So you need the sleep to recover. And when you're stressed and always pumping cortisol, you can't actually recover. That's the point. So actually, there are 8 domains: sleep and calm, active mind, active body, healthy gut, antioxidants, B vitamins, brain fats, and sugar carbs. So what we did, we found the best professor, like Professor David Smith was the man for the B vitamins. You might have heard of Professor Robert Lustig. You know, he's University of California. He's the best for, you know, for sugar and so on. We found the 8 world leading professors, and they joined our charity for nothing, because they all know that the only way to deal with Alzheimer's is to prevent it. And the reason why there will never be a drug is because it is driven by structure, function, utilization, the whole lot. You can't just take a drug, you know, that stops that process. There never will be a drug. It just doesn't work like that. And then we built what's called the Dementia Risk Index questionnaire. So now you go to foodforthebrain.org and for free do the cognitive function test, which is not a questionnaire. It's interactive. You find out where you score on a traffic light system, green, yellow, orange, red. And we're tracking 380,000 people. You then fill in a questionnaire and it shows you your risk. 100% means you're doing everything wrong. 0% means you're doing everything right. There's nothing in there that you cannot change. And it shows you across these 8 domains, which ones you're doing well on, which are green, and which ones you're doing badly on, which are red or orange or yellow. And then what we're doing right now, in fact, we've soft launched it and improving it literally every week. And this is the only thing that we really want people to join and pay for, is you pay for something called Cognition. And it's $5 a month for 6 months, or £50 a year. And then what happens, you're a friend of the charity, you've joined our Citizens Health Action, so you're now part of ongoing research. But what happens is it shows you your two weakest links, and you click the one you want to work on. And for the next month, you're going to get a whole lot of communications, some by email, some by text, things to watch, things to read, things to do, things to measure, as a group that you can join, a Facebook group and so on. And, and I have to say this very genuinely, because we literally go from sort of month to month, week to week, you know, with no money, we get a little bit more and we can program a little bit deeper and we can make the service a little bit better. And, you know, anyone who joins Cognition becomes what we call a friend of Food for the Brain. But you can also go on to foodforthebrain.org/friend and just become a friend for £50 a year or £5 a month. Then you get Cognition and you get all our past webinars and you get a whole lot of content in my library. But most of all, you support an incredibly focused, you know, prevention research strategy. And the next layer we want to add is a, you know, which of course may be a bit difficult in South Africa, but it's a simple pinprick blood test that measures your homocysteine, measures your omega-3, measures your vitamin D, measures your sugar balance, which is called HbA1c. You'll know about that. Our dream is to have 1 million people who are measuring themselves every year, making changes, just little changes, combinations of lot, as you know, as a health coach, just combinations of lots of little changes, measuring it so you can see your risk go down and down and down and down and down. We hope that individuals will cut their risk by up to 3/4. And we hope that, technically, if we get enough people doing this, we could certainly expect 1/3 less cases of dementia. Now, of course, the money, the suffering, it's crazy. I mean, this disease is going to cost $1 trillion, you know, in the not too distant future, and so much suffering. And there really is no need to end one's life with, you know, several years, even a decade of dysfunctional mind. It's, our brain is what makes us unique. And it's our brain that is really under challenge in the modern world. And as you'll know, every single one of those risk factors are risk factors for all the other diseases. If you engage and you bring your risk down for Alzheimer's, you're going to be bringing your risk down for diabetes and heart disease and cancer and, you know, arthritis and, you know, all of these largely unnecessary diseases. But don't wait until it's too late.
Exactly. And what I really love about your approach is you just didn't just think about, oh, gosh, there's a problem. There's a lot of people with Alzheimer's out there. We need to spread the news, put the education out there. You came up with actionable steps once again. You know, what can you do? How can you address this? Because we know that's often where people get stuck. They have the info, but they don't know how to implement them. They don't know where to start. And there's stuff coming in the way, barriers that comes in the way. So I think that's wonderful. And what you mentioned earlier is there's not a one single cause for Alzheimer's. It's really more of a process and different systems in the body and our environments, our relationships, our state of mind, all of these things play a role. So it just reminds me again of how important a whole or holistic approach is when it comes to many of these lifestyle diseases, right? And we need to, in other words, not just focus on nutrition or just movement. It's a bigger picture that we need to take into account here. So you mentioned quite a few things, and I love the 8 steps or the 8 areas of research that you've talked about. And I've got a few questions on some of them. So the first one was sugar, right? So in your research, you recommend having a low GL diet. So we know that the glucose, if the glucose is interrupted, if the energy supply is interrupted, I guess that impacts the brain. And that's why you're saying people really flourish on a ketone diet where, you know, you rely on fat as an energy source instead of the sugar. So is that what happens with Alzheimer's? Is it the fact that the glucose supply is sometimes interrupted, or the fact that it causes inflammation in the system?
Well, there's a couple of new things that we've learned. The first is that there was a switch in the sugar industry away from pure glucose and sugar cane towards high fructose corn syrup, which actually introduced more fructose. Now, you and I think of fructose, is quite good. It's sort of lower GI, GL, and so on. And, it's fine in fruit because you've got the fibers and it slows down its release. And actually that fructose, a lot of it is eaten by bacteria in the gut who make all sorts of good things. But once it's been highly purified, as it is now, as the cheapest sugar, so that's what things are being sweetened with, high fructose corn syrup. Actually, that is particularly damaging for the brain. So that's the first thing. But that direction towards diabetes, where the receptors for insulin get damaged and reduced, insulin insensitivity, that actually what you're getting is sort of fuel supply blockage to the brain, because the insulin receptors aren't working. Now, what happens, I think, for a lot of people is that their sugar engine, the mitochondria is what we call them, the energy factories in cells, the sugar engines are getting damaged. So what really amazed me, because I always thought that to switch to running on ketones, which are a fuel made in the liver from fat, so if you fast, your body starts to break down fat, makes ketones, so you can measure them in the blood. If you give a brain cell glucose as a fuel, or ketones as a fuel, prefers ketones. And it's, babies are born fat. And 75% of all the energy derived from breast milk is going to the brain. And breast milk is also high in fat. So, and they're making up to 1 million connections a second, 1 million connections a second. So the brain loves ketones. But I thought you'd have to be avoiding all carbs to benefit from ketones. And yet a very, very good study, in fact, two studies came out, which took ketones are made from a very specific kind of fat, which is sometimes called medium chain triglyceride, but very specifically one fat called C8. It's got eight carbons. So it's, and coconut oil has it in it, but it's only 7% C8. So this study took actual C8 oil. In the UK, I got this purified, and we have a product called Keto Fast, pure C8 oil. Gave people with dementia and pre-dementia and Alzheimer's, two studies, C8 oil, 2 tablespoons a day. And measured a 230% increase in energy produced in the brain from ketones, and their cognition improved. So here's a, someone says, my dad's got pretty crap memory. I say, yeah, get the homocysteine measure, give him B vitamins, probably B12, high dose he's going to need, because he's not absorbing it. That's the point. If you're not absorbing it, you need 500 micrograms, while you and I only need 10. Give him omega-3s, no question, fish oils, but get some C8 oil. Give him a couple of tablespoons, because it might actually, provide fuel to the rather messed up energy factories in the brain. So there's something that you can actually do, that we sort of didn't really quite understand before. And it's a very hot new area, how to provide ketones, to the brain. And so, get a degree of recovery.
So are you saying that it's not necessary to eliminate all carbs? If you include the CH oil, then you will...
Eight for eight carbons. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So you don't have to be on a ketogenic diet to get a benefit from C8 oil.
Okay. That's lovely.
Which is fascinating,
Okay.
By the way, I want to say one thing, because I'm sure some of the people who listen are... practitioners, this is a bit less for the member of the public. We did a webinar for the public, which is called Upgrade Your Brain, which is really good, to get all this information. But we got our professors together, and we did a 4-hour masterclass, so they're each presenting, half an hour or so, and it's recorded, and it's £20, or if you're a friend, it's £15, so it's cheaper. And it's amazing because, these are the top in the world and they all go through the evidence. So if you're a practitioner and you really want to hear the evidence from the leading people in the world, and what really made me laugh was at the end, we had them all together for a question and answer and the rest of it. And it was Professor Lustig, our sugar expert. He said, you know, I loved all these presentations. And the amazing thing was not a single person mentioned amyloid, which is the target of these drugs. So
exactly.
When you actually understand what's driving it, what the proven prevention factors are, where the evidence is for disease risk modifying changes, you don't even hear this word amyloid, which is simply a target for drugs to potentially make money, and they failed appallingly.
Exactly.
And yet that, I mean, one of those big pharma guys came to Professor David Smith and said, you know, if we could patent, you know, your B vitamins, this is a multi-billion dollar drug.
But they can't.
But you cannot patent something that nature has made. So the sickness of this is we actually know how to prevent this debilitating disease. Prevention message is being actively blocked because it interferes with the ability to make money.
Yeah.
That's the truth.
Yeah, you know? Very sad truth.
So we have to wake up and not wait and think there'll be a drug, but actually wake up, do the test, see where you're at, find out where your risk factors are, and do what you can, get a health coach, you know, and make a difference. Because otherwise, exactly. You, along with millions of others, are going to end up spending your last decade in a terrible state, wishing that you could remember what it was that Patrick Holford said in that podcast.
Yes, exactly.
All those years ago, you know.
Yeah. No, it's true. Hey, and I think it's kind of empowering to know that you know, you can take control of it yourself. There's a lot that you can do. You don't have to wait for the medical institutions necessarily to, you know, give it the go ahead. There's a lot that you can do before it hopefully get there. So are there some of the medical institutions and places that do recognize it and start to implement it as well?
Yeah, not really implementing. I mean, in fact, what happened in 2010 when David Smith did his study, I said, what next? And he said, I hope within 5 years, it will be standard NHS policy. And I said, what would it be? And the answer was, do the cognitive function test, everyone over 50 for sure. If not good, measure the homocysteine. If not good, take the B vitamins. And I was skeptical. And that's why we developed, you know, if you like, a path that people can take. What we're doing is definitely what healthcare systems should be doing. And the honest truth is, until nutrition is at the very top of the healthcare agenda, we will continue to have what really is a failed, broken healthcare system, because we just get more and more people with diseases that they didn't need to have, you know, overloading the system that is treating the diseases, you know, shutting the door when the horse is bolted. You know, and we'll go, oh God, our healthcare system needs more money, and we need more doctors, and we need more nurses, and we need more drugs, and we need all that stuff. And the answer is, we actually need none of that if we took nutrition and we took prevention seriously. It's you know, that is the key. And the truth is, we can do it. You know, we can do it ourselves. And you health coaches and the nutritional therapists and the functional medicine doctors, you know, and that section of the public who are waking up, you know, we can do it. We don't need the system to support us. So no, it's not being supported. And to give you a little example, we've done everything that we've done in our charity since about 2010, having raised £50 from individuals. Some have been a bit more generous. Occasionally someone gives us 5,000 or 1,000, whatever. And we've done everything we've done for less than £250,000 in total, you know, since then. And the total, and that is more than the money that was spent by the UK government on actual Alzheimer's prevention research.
Wow. You know? Wow, sure.
And the terrible thing is, even the charities, you know, the leading charities in Alzheimer's, if you actually look what they spend their money on, they're doing stuff on genes, they're doing stuff on mechanisms that are kind of like the feeder research for the drug industry. And if you say, actually, how much of your money is being spent on prevention, it's like less than 1%. And now I want to leave you one funny thing, because actually of that, you know, 100 grand or whatever that was spent by the UK government on prevention research, most of it was spent on lowering high blood pressure. So the thinking is this: if your blood pressure is high, it's a risk factor. So if I lower it with drugs, will I reduce the risk? So a very good, there have been a few studies, but the last study, the best study, the biggest study, your blood pressure is meant to be 120 over 80. And if it's above 140 over 90, you're diagnosed with hypertension. So they gave people high dose blood pressure medication or lower dose to either drive them below 120 over 80 or below 140 over 90. And a big study. And they basically showed that if they treated 1,000 people, there would be one less case of dementia. Okay. Now, this was a sub trial in a much bigger trial, so they didn't mention side effects. But I went back through the studies and I got to the actual original study, which wasn't on dementia as such, to find out how many of those 1,000, given the high dose, high blood pressure treatment, would have side effects. And the answer is, was 338 would have an SAE. As it's called, serious adverse effect reaction. What is a serious adverse effect reaction? It's death or prolonged hospitalization. So maybe one less case of dementia and maybe 338 serious adverse effects, right?
No, it's ridiculous.
So the thinking is, you know, they're not even thinking that the blood pressure, which is a risk, and the diabetes, which is a risk, and the obesity, which is a risk, and you know, this, all the other factors are driven by too much sugar, lack of B vitamins, no omegas, lack of exercise, not eating enough fruit and veg, and all the rest of it.
Exactly.
So the problem is that there isn't even the thinking yet to do prevention properly.
Exactly.
You know, let alone the will or the mechanism.
It's so a very slow process, right?
It's a slow process. So honestly, don't wait for someone else to do it for you. You are the only person who can change your health. Join our Citizens Health Action Scientist group at foodforthebrain.org. Do the test. Please become a friend. Get involved. Share it with others.
Awesome.
And then together we can make the world a better place for those who choose to make a few simple changes.
Lovely. Thank you, Patrick. So I want to, as a quick summary, just go through those eight. Is it eight? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Elements that you've touched on, just as a quick summary, and then we are going to end off. So firstly, to be cautious and to be conscious of the amount of sugar, your sugar intake, right? And going for your slow release, low GL carbohydrate. So we not necessarily don't have to eliminate all carbs. We can, you know, get those ketones that will support the brain if we take some coconut oil. So that's a really great hack that you told us about today. And I think that's also interesting why I've often heard reference being made to Alzheimer's as being diabetes type 3, right? So the sugar link, very interesting. And then the brain fats, the omega-3s, the B vitamins result in 73% less shrinkage in the right combination. So it's not just the one or the other. They need to be in combination to provide you with that benefit. And then the antioxidants are polyphenols, they're nutrients for the brain. So eating, I think, a lot of variety, I guess, hey, and making sure that you're getting enough servings of fruit and vegetable.
Yeah, and herbs and spices and the berries are very good. I know they're not a sort of traditionally grown food, but blueberries are superb. And cacao is fantastic, you know. So nothing wrong with cacao, just without the sugar, you know, much less sugar. That's another one. Yeah.
Awesome.
Teas. Yeah. Tea is good too. Tea is good.
A lot of antioxidants
in
there.
Green tea is very good. Yeah.
Yeah, and then also taking care of your gut. So I know there's still some research that need to be done on this topic, but we know that there's a connection between the brain and the gut. It's linked via the vagus nerve, and a lot of our neurotransmitters, our serotonin, our dopamine gets produced in the gut. So if the gut is not healthy, it makes sense that it is going to impact the brain. And then having an active body. So having enough muscle, very interesting link there between more muscle and improved cognitive function. I think that's fascinating as well. And an active mind. So being socially, not, you know, participating socially and I think something that I read in the research was about learning a new language as well. Very stimulating. So stimulating your brain is very important. And then lastly, relaxation and calm and sleep. And just one last question that I'm very curious about. So you said too little or too much sleep has an impact on the brain. So I can kind of make sense of if you're not getting enough sleep, but where's the link with too much and cognitive impairment?
Well, sometimes, you know, these are sort of in a way linked to other diseases. When people are just very tired, so they have no energy and they can't, you know, and they just sleep and they sleep and they sleep and they can't wake up. I mean, that also occurs in depression sometimes, you know.
Okay.
So it could be other factors. It may not. We also, you know, there's a balance between sleep, active lifestyle, physically active leisure activities, and downtime. So we know that more than 4 hours sedentary downtime increases risk. So, you know, if you're watching telly a lot, you know, so you've kind of got those three things: sleep, active lifestyle, and rest.
Okay.
And the rest doesn't want to be too long, and the sleep doesn't want to be too long, and the active lifestyle wants to be long. I mean, something that is a bit of a shocker, but it is also true: too much sunlight increases dementia risk. Too
really?
Little, yeah, too little increases dementia risk. And of course, we go, well, of course, too little, because, you know, vitamin D, you know, the sun stimulates it and so on. And by the way, on the research, the optimal is about 2 hours exposure to sun in the summer and about one hour in the winter, something like that. And, you know, of course, it's a bit different if you live on the equator to, you know, where we are, where we can't make vitamin D for long. So why would too much, you know, like 4, 5, 6 hours outdoors be a problem? And the answer is that, I mean, we know about skin cancer, obviously. But, you know, the sun is radiation and it does damage us, you know, cataracts, for example, too much sun exposure, more cataracts and so on. But it also heats the brain. It literally heats the brain and we get radiation through the brain. So, you know, it's not always exactly what we think, but these are very big studies, often involving a million people. So, and we know that you make most of your vitamin D anyway in the first half hour.
Yeah.
So sun is good and bad, and sleep is good and bad, and there's an optimal place, you know, somewhere in the, you know, in the middle.
I love how all these elements kind of work together to nudge us to find balance, you know, not living in extremes, having too much of one element in our lives. It's, you know, it's going to be detrimental in one way or the other. So, Okay, so thank you, Patrick. This really was very, very insightful. And I think that the work that you're doing is so much needed. And it's very powerful to know that there really is a lot that we can do to prevent Alzheimer's, and that we should start as soon as possible. So I know you've mentioned where people could go. So it's foodforthebrain.org, right, to do the cognitive test. Another recommendation would be to, you know, get your homocysteine levels tested. Do the cognitive test on the website. And that's where they
that's
could
start. Foodforthebrain.org. If you're a practitioner, you might want to check out the masterclass. You'll see it. If you're a member of the public, there's a very good webinar called Upgrade Your Brain.
Okay.
It's another way to share, you know, this information with others. But most of all, do the test, fill out the questionnaire, get involved, see how it is for yourself, because you'll get a lot of information for nothing. But I hope that you will join Cognition or become a friend and get more involved in our Citizens Health Action campaign.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Patrick, and thank you for listening.
Thank you.